DigiTiki.com.
Say, listen, how do you do those bird calls on Quiet Village? Show us. Fantastic.
Welcome to the Quiet Village. Welcome back for another visit here at the Quiet Village. I am your host, DigiTiki, coming to you direct from DigiTiki.com, broadcasting from deep within the jungly heart of the Quiet Village. I've got my Mai Tai right here. And just like soup, you should never slurp your Mai Tai. I just wanted to prove that I had it right there. All right, let's get rolling. I have an exceptional show for you. Actually, two exceptional shows, because this is going to be a two-parter. And I am very, very proud to introduce Leslie Baxter, the daughter of Les Baxter. And she and I talked a little bit ahead of time, and we really hit it off. And we kind of both agreed we're just going to just sit down and talk. She is joining me via satellite, though. We're not in person, but we did talk, and it was really wonderful. So I actually, this is going to be less of an interview and more of a conversation, but you're going to learn an awful lot, as I did, about Les Baxter, about growing up with Les Baxter, basically, and also a lot of things that I don't think anybody else knew about Les's career and things that he accomplished, and I was amazed. So mix that Mai Tai, sit back, and just enjoy this wonderful part one of this wonderful conversation with Leslie Baxter. And before we go, I just want to, before we get into it, I just want to say a big mahalo to Leslie Baxter for coming on the show. All right. Here we go. Joining me now in the Quiet Village is Leslie Baxter.
I'm so happy to meet you.
Aloha. It's so happy to have you.
Aloha. I am so thrilled to meet you. And first, before we get started, I wanted to say how much I love Lahaina
Sunset. Oh, my goodness. Oh, thank you.
It's a beautiful album. I had a conversation with Rory Snyder about something, and he said, you know, you really ought to listen to Marty's album. And I said, you know, I think I will, because I make it a policy never to listen to anything past 1970.
Oh yeah. I can understand that.
So I was so happy when I received it, because it's not only is it beautiful, but you're not hit over the head with the exotic genre. It's a beautiful album. And I was especially touched by a song that was about a fishing village, fishermen.
Oh, yes. The old fishing village. Yeah.
I want to tell you, it reminded me so much of when Dad and I would go to the Coco Palms Hotel.
Oh, I wish I could have been there. Oh, I wish I could have seen that place.
It was a marvelous little hotel on the Garden Isle of Kauai. But it was very, much, even though it didn't have a fishing village, it was very much authentic and serene, like a fishing village. And when I heard your song, it reminded me of the Coco Palms, And I wanted to tell you thank you for the lovely memory.
Oh, thank you. That makes me really happy. I'm so happy to hear that.
It's a beautiful album, and I hope you have much success with it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, when I went to Lahaina, it was just for a 1 week vacation getaway with my wife. And I've had people ask me, did you plan on writing record? Did you go and write things down with the intent?
Right.
And I said, nope, I just went to relax. And I was so inspired by the place. And I just came back and started writing. And it was fantastic. Well,
this is what's so important and what a lot of the exotica composers are missing is that you have to live the music. You know, one thing that I think set my father apart from some of the current exotica musicians is they've never lived it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dad traveled to these exotic places and he needed to be there. He needed to eat what they ate, sleep there, listen to them, live what they lived on a daily basis in order to authentically create the music.
You know, that was actually something it was a question I had, but didn't realize I had, you know, because the whole tiki genre, you know, they make a real thing about it. It was created in Hollywood. It wasn't exactly real, but the fact that now something I didn't know was that your dad actually went to those places and absorbed those cultures. He wasn't just making it up out of whole cloth.
You know, and that was one of the most important things that I wanted to talk about today was that of all of the wonderful qualities my father had, one of the most important is that he was authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And he would not write about a culture unless he knew about every aspect of that culture.
That is fascinating. That's really fascinating.
You know,
to
we
learn.
Traveled, you know, we wanted to go to we traveled to South America and Africa, and we very much wanted to go to Congo, but it was very dangerous, you know. Mm-hmm. So we ended up in South Africa, and I proclaimed to my father that I really needed to save elephants.
Okay.
So he said, okay, fine, you want to save elephants? We'll go save elephants. And he taught me a very good lesson. You know, we went to Zimbabwe and Uganda, and I got to see the reality of the way these people lived and the beauty in which they, in their spare time, enjoyed their lives. And it was through music. You know, what a marvelous father to create an atmosphere for you where you not only learn about a culture, but you learn about what your father is all about.
Yes. One of the things that I found that I really enjoyed about Les Baxter's music was he incorporated a lot of Afro-Cuban rhythms, you know, Latin American and African rhythms that were just infectious. I love those rhythms.
You know, Father really, he did not understand, even though we lived in Hawaii and we visited French Polynesia, he didn't understand it as well as he did the South American culture. He really understood them on some level. Mm-hmm. And so that was his preference as far as music. When I first became aware of the tiki genre group on Facebook, I was fascinated because they were so loyal and so wonderful to Dad. Yet I knew nothing about where they were coming from, which was very Hawaiian, because we had learned quite differently from Dad about South America and its roots.
Gotcha. Yeah.
I'm so grateful to that group that I am not a part of. I am not in the in crowd of the tiki group, but I'm so grateful for their acknowledgement that Dad was so authentic when it came to creating Exotica.
Yes. Well, I mean, you look at the tunes that he wrote, they are essentially the kind of like the jazz fake book. They're the songbook of Exotica. You know, of course, Quiet Village is the Exotica anthem. You know, being a musician myself, I don't know if you know this, I had a salsa band for 10 years. I was the piano player.
Good for you.
And I loved it. So I absorbed so much from Latin rhythms that I could, you know, pick out things. And the one thing I tell people, I said, you know, Quiet Village is actually a really slow cha-cha, you know, with the ch-ch-ch-ch.
Exactly.
And they look at me and they go, it is? I said, yeah, it's...
And you know, you're absolutely right. And Dad spent as much time as he could in Central America because he wasn't a great fan of the Hollywood, you know, party scene in the 1950s, and would retreat to Mexico and Central America. And the stories that he would send me coming out of there were absolutely marvelous, you know. As I said before, he lived it. He didn't just learn about the music, he lived it.
It must have been a little more authentic back then too, because now everything is so globalized. I can imagine, you know, you see old photos of Mexico or even of Waikiki, and it's much more rural. It seems to be less globalized, you know.
Right.
I'm sure he got a much deeper understanding.
I was listening to Valley High.
Yeah.
This morning, and my father's arrangements are absolutely unbelievably beautiful.
I would say at listening as a musician, listening to his music as a musician.
Yes.
I have discovered so many intricate, very, very subtle lines moving that if you listen to it once, you almost miss. But then if you really give it a hard listen, you realize there's a lot going on. Those arrangements were not just simple arrangements. Thank you.
know, that when I listen to my father's music now, I am absolutely astounded at the intricacy and the lush, beautiful, experimental beauty of the way he put sound together with all of the strings and the exotic instruments. I have so much respect for the way he put music together for us.
Yes, it's very layered, and it's something that, as a listener, the deeper you dive, the more you find, which is a wonderful thing.
Yes, and I remember many years ago, some of my peers were musicians. I was at Kevin Bacon's house, and he very much loved music, and we were listening to several pieces of current music, and he said, listen to this and listen to that, and look at the way they did this. And I said, Kevin, listen to that. And he called me back a couple of weeks later, and he said, I'm blown away by your father's music. Everything we have learned today, we learned from your dad. I was very flattered by that.
It's very true, because, well, first of all, I'm just going to be a star person here and say, now I have 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, right?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
But, you know, he's very right. And what you said earlier about not listening to music past 1970, America's mid-century easy listening, I guess is what I would call it, easy listening genre, was it required a knowledge of the music back then. You know, they wrote for an orchestra. You know, even a small group had the parts written and arranged, and there was a sense of care that was taken with the music. I think after 1970, it became more groove oriented. People would just start grooving and then improvise over something and come up with a melody. And, you know, not to denigrate that, there's some wonderful songs that came that I grew up singing from after 1970, but there's definitely a demarcation point where the band, the orchestra, started to
absolutely
fade.
And you know, when I occasionally went to school, not very often because Dad and I traveled so often, but after school, he would take me to Capitol Records and for a session. And the engineers would say, I could hear them in the background say, all right, everybody, get ready. Here comes Les, you know, because he would walk in, he would tear everything apart and put it back together. He was very commanding in the studio, and he knew exactly what he wanted, and he knew every instrument. He knew how to play every instrument in front of him. And some of the most famous composers of our time, like John Williams, was my father's piano player in studio.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that. Oh my gosh.
Yes. And you know, Chico and Tito and, you know, Plas Johnson and, you know, Dad hired only the best. But the engineers used to panic when my dad came in the studio because he could lay down a track faster than anyone. And he knew exactly what he wanted, and the best musicians in the world knew what he wanted. And it used to really piss Frank Sinatra off, because he would come in after Dad and struggle to get his stuff out there, you know?
Yeah.
Between you and I, you know, he had his favorites, and, you know, they weren't always on the ball.
Yeah.
So it was really fun to see Dad work in the studio at Capitol, you know, and it was a beautiful experience for me, and treasure it.
That time at Capitol, I mean, Capitol was on top of the world. They had all the biggies, and
absolutely,
that must have really been something to be at Capitol during that era.
And, you know, we all have Glenn Wallachs. I don't know if you know who, but Glenn Wallachs, I'm getting older, so you have to excuse my mind gaps, but he had the first record store in Hollywood where they sold vinyls.
Mm-hmm.
And he went from selling vinyl records to building Capitol Records.
Really? And, okay.
Yes. And the groundbreaking of Capitol Records was all over the newspaper. And you see Dad and Glenn and a few other important composers of the time. And Glenn Wallachs is breaking ground on the beautiful Capitol Records building we see now.
Mm-hmm. That is a beautiful building.
Yes, and Glenn Wallachs was responsible for all of it. Mm. And he loved Dad, and Dad loved him. And like Dad says in some of his interviews, you know, darling, they gave me carte blanche to do whatever I wanted.
That must have felt good.
And so he did.
Yeah.
Le sacre des sauvages, you know, the ritual of the savage. Glenn really allowed Dad to do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted. And we owe a great deal to him for Dad's success. I remember walking out of Capitol Records once with Dad, and I think Dad had one of the first stars on Hollywood and Vine, which was where Capitol Records is located. And someone was standing out on the sidewalk smoking and dropped his cigarette on Dad's star and smashed it out. And Dad and I looked at each other and we just laughed, you know. I mean, you can't make it up.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't know Dad built that building, you know, with the income he provided to Capitol. You know, if I would say anything to people that enjoy Dad's music, is that I would want them to know how extremely humble and dignified he was. How many talents he had that people really didn't know about. You know, he had so many different talents besides music.
Yeah, what were his hobbies outside of music? I mean, obviously, I don't know how he had any time for anything else with the amount of music he churned out. It was...
you know, he and my mother used to think, they used to have conversations that Exotica was started in Paris in the late 1920s.
Really?
Yes. They traveled to Paris. Dad started out as a concert pianist.
Okay, yes.
And when you play Rachmaninoff at 4 years old, you know, that's going to lead you places that are quite extraordinary. And I think when he moved to Detroit with his mother to learn more about music, he got hooked up with the jazz, blues, and I think they greatly influenced him. He learned how classical music and jazz were related.
Mm-hmm. One of the albums I really enjoy is African Jazz, and I love the cover artwork on that one, but you can definitely hear very bluesy lines in that album.
It's funny, when I was younger growing up, you know, all I wanted to hear was Congo Train because of the...
the whistle?
Because of the whistle.
I love that that's in there, yeah.
You know, and so Congo Train, I absolutely love. Jungle Jazz, I love because I'm so... you know, such a fan of Plas Johnson.
Yes.
You know, so I love jungle jazz, but my absolute heart is in Jewels of the Sea and Ports of Pleasure.
Oh, yes. Excellent records, yes.
I mean, you know, if I put my Bose headphones on and listen to Jewels of the Sea and Ports of Pleasure, I'm so grateful to be Les Baxter's daughter.
I just discovered another record I gave a really good listen to, and I believe it was Caribbean Moonlight.
Yes, I've heard, you know, I haven't listened to it as much as some of the other ones of Dad's, because I hear that Caribbean Moonlight, not all of the songs were written by Father, so I wanted to focus... when I have free time, on the ones that Dad wrote.
Yeah.
You know. But I hear Caribbean Moonlight is an enormously successful, has a great following.
I have to say I hadn't listened to it that much until recently. Yeah. And I sat down and listened to it, and I loved it. There's a couple of very Exotica oriented tracks on there that surprised me.
Does it have vocals on it? Do you know?
I don't believe it does, if I recall.
Because, you know, Dad was so fabulous with vocals. You know, he was a wonderful singer.
He was part of the Meltones, right?
Well, but he just had this innate ability to be able to bring people together to do beautiful harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it reminds me of the times that when I was growing up, that some of the most infamous boy bands would come to our home and ask Dad for advice on how to harmonize.
Wow.
You know, we had the Beach Boys on a regular basis. The Beatles on a regular basis, yes. And I got in so much trouble because I was told not to tell anybody that the Beatles were coming to the home. And of course, I told my best friend, which was a big mistake. And we were mobbed, you know.
Yeah.
But I think Dad's ability to sing and harmonize is underrated. And I hear him very often on some of the albums that people listen to. I can hear my father's voice, which is marvelous.
Mm. I'm not a millionaire, but I haven't got time to care. Got no future, got no plan. Still, I guess I'm a lucky man. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Well, all right.
I wanted to tell you that growing up as Les Baxter's daughter was an absolute privilege, and an absolute blast. There was no adult supervision at all.
Wow.
It was really fun. It was really fun. And I really didn't know how much fun until I saw, you know, I would see things on the television. Like, I remember the first time I saw Jamie Lee Curtis on the television, I said, I know her. She and I went skinny dipping the other day.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. There's a story right there.
You know, well, Tony Curtis was a good friend of Dad's, and we used to trade pools. Uh-huh. You know, sometimes we went to their pool and sometimes they came to our pool. So, you know, I really didn't know how privileged and how wonderful my life was until I got older.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you grew up with that was your baseline, right? You grew up with that.
Yeah.
That is fascinating. I love the little stories. You know, I've seen seminars on Les's music, on collecting the records and things, but the thing I love the most are the little stories like that, you know?
Well, you know, there were so many stories, you know. I was very fortunate to travel with Dad, with some amazing people. Tom Hormel of Hormel Meats.
Okay.
Was our neighbor, and he loved exotica music. Funny story, we were going out on, he had bought a big sailboat.
Yeah.
And we were going out on a sail, and Dad was a little wary of Tom. He was very eccentric. And Dad said to him, Tom, now make sure you have a radio. It's very important. And Tom said, well, of course we do. How else are we going to listen to your music?
Not that kind of radio.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy.
It was an extraordinary life. And I'm so grateful for it. And every time I listen to I try and listen to one composition of my father's every day. I'm moved deeply. I'm so grateful to be his daughter and hope that I can live up to and carry on his legacy. And I'm so grateful to the group of people that I have met online. And I can only refer to them as the Tiki group.
Right. Yep.
I'm so grateful to them for acknowledging how they've incorporated dad's music into their lifestyle, into their community that they have grown. And so I hope you will convey that to them for me.
I will. Your dad's music is the soundtrack of Tiki, because it just embodies that kind of faraway mystic lands, you know. And the time that he was releasing these records in the 50s and 60s about exotic lands with exotic titles, you know, one of the things that I tell people is some of these places that he mentions in the song titles could have been on the moon for most people, because travel was much more expensive. It was less accessible at that time. So,
and Dad wasn't a flashy person. He could have cared less about how he dressed or what kind of car he drove.
Mm-hmm.
Although he did go to Mort Saul, the comedian's house, one evening and came home with a Citroen Maserati.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But that was the only time I've ever seen him. But for the most part, he was so humble, and so it didn't care much for the fixings of Hollywood, and was more interested, as I said before, in being authentic.
Yeah.
His arrangements were beautiful.
Yes, they were.
And I've heard very few people that have been able to replicate that, although many have tried.
Yeah. Well,
and
you
I
know,
thank you so much for Lying the Sunset.
Thank you. I can't thank you enough for that. I mean, that was
I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, thank you. I was worried about it a little bit because it's so slow and dreamy. I thought, oh gosh, this is gonna put people to sleep.
Oh no. Listen, I don't like to be hit over the head with exotica.
Yeah.
You know, I love Martin Denny, but I could do without the birds. I know that there are many people who adore him and follow him. I prefer my father's Quiet Village.
It's
supposed to be a quiet village.
It's fascinating to me. Because I get different responses from people, because when I released my digital version of the record, I put the whole record on there without the bird calls, without the waves, because I recorded it that way and I fell in love with it like that. But I know, you know, a lot of people kind of expect the bird calls, so I put them in, and I liked it with the bird calls. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to put both versions so people can pick, because it was, I couldn't say which one I liked better. I liked them both.
Well, the Lahaina Sunset that I listened to did not have the bird calls.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Am I correct?
Yes, I because you have the little flash drive, right?
Right.
Yeah, so there's a version without the bird calls, the whole album without it, yeah.
And I absolutely adored it and would be proud to play it at any of my cocktail parties.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That is a huge compliment, because that's really what I wrote it for. I wrote it for it to be kind of background music that people could just play at their little home tiki bar or at a dinner party, cocktail party.
And it does, and it's absolutely is perfect you know.
Well, thank you.
If I could give a lot of the composers or musicians today any advice, I would say stop learning about it and start feeling it. Start living it.
Feel it, yeah. And
because that was the whole point of Exotica, was to live the dream.
Yes, yes, and to provide to set the mood.
To set the mood, the ambiance.
Yeah.
You know, forget about the chords and forget about, you know, go from your gut.
And also on the record, I'm sure you noticed Tune for Crab Rangoon.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That was my homage because of Tune from Rangoon.
Right.
And I always joked in my head, because I can never do anything with a straight face, and my wife goes nuts.
Oh, good.
Sometimes.
I'm so glad. We'll get along marvelously.
It drives my wife crazy sometimes. She always says that, you know, you can spoil any mood by cracking a joke at any time. I said, yeah, I can't help it. But for the longest time, I considered that song, and I had in my head Tune for Crab Rangoon. So when I came to writing that song, I thought, you know, I was going to name it something after Lahaina because it kind of inspired me. But I thought, You know what? I'm going to use that title.
Well, you have to, because let me tell you, my dad had a marvelous sense of humor and used to absolutely, you know, put people to the floor. And it's so important to do exactly what you think is would be the very best version.
Mm-hmm.
And so I support you 100%.
Thank you. Thank you. Besides, who doesn't love Crab Rangoon? It's so tasty.
Oh, I know. And it's so hard to find an authentic one.
It is. It really is. I've had it at a couple of restaurants, and I've only had it good maybe once or twice. I think the Mai Kai in Fort Lauderdale had fantastic Crab Rangoon. But yeah,
Mai Kai. Tell me the name of it again.
The Mai Kai in Fort Lauderdale. It's a huge place.
Do you know, I have never been to Fort Lauderdale.
Really?
No.
I remember the first time I couldn't believe the humidity, because I grew up in Southern California where it's dry.
Right.
I could not believe the humidity.
Yeah.
But the Mai Kai is this. It opened, I believe, in '61, and it's a tiki themed restaurant, and it seats like 670 people, and it's got different rooms. It's amazing. It's decked out like I would call it tiki Disneyland. You can't
right.
There's, you know, vintage Leiteg velvet paintings. There's, you know, hand carved tikis from the 50s and 60s. They even have what they say is a real shrunken head in a glass case. They say it's real.
Marvelous.
But
marvelous.
And the food is, it's literally like walking into a time machine. And
you know, isn't that interesting? Because my father my mother and father, my mother was a concert pianist.
Mm.
I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know that, no.
She could play by ear. Yes, my father was invited to the great director, George Fitzmaurice, who was my grandfather, who directed all of Rudolph Valentino's movies.
Oh, wow.
And my father was invited to George Fitzmaurice's home. And my father, having strong ties to Paris jazz, wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
So he arrived at George's house, and there was my mother, who was absolutely stunning. And, you know, it was sort of a love at first sight, but the the cute part of the story is that Dad sat down on the piano at my grandmother's request and played a very difficult piece. I don't know if it was Rite of Spring or The Firebird or something, but Dad played it and played it beautifully. And my mother very coyly sat down next to him. And he said, "Oh, do you play the piano?" And she said, "Oh, well, I try." My father, not knowing that she could play by ear, that she could hear anything once and then play it without ever having studied it. So she scooted him over on the piano bench and played what he just played more beautifully than he played it.
Oh, wow.
And he turned to her and said, "Will you marry me?"
Ah.
And they were married.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was a marvelous time. My grandfather was the quintessential 1920s era movie producer.
Uh-huh.
Interesting man.
Yeah. I can imagine. That's a wonderful story. I love stories like that. I love I love it because you know,
well, when he met his match when he married my mother, you know, and I don't know why we got on the subject, but.
So he was born in Texas?
He was born in a small town in Texas. And for the life of me, Marty, I cannot understand how this little Texas boy holding a chicken in the Dust Bowl wound up the Sucre de Sauvage.
That's,
you know,
that is kind of a world away, isn't it?
I still don't understand. Except that his mother was an extraordinary person. And saw, I remember that my grandmother telling me that the first classical piece my father played on the piano at 4 years old was a piece from Rachmaninoff. And oh, wow. She knew then that she needed to take him somewhere else besides Texas. So they moved to Detroit, and he received a scholarship at the Detroit Conservatory of Music. And being that it was during the Depression, she had left her family and had to go to work in a department store in order to support my father and her family back home.
Mm-hmm.
So they really earned their place in history.
Yeah, she sounds gutsy.
She was marvelous, a marvelous woman, not a typical Texas housewife.
Yeah. You know, my grandparents came from Texas, or my grandmother was from a small town called Sundown, Texas.
Uh-huh.
I remember that she always
and
talked about.
And what do you
it.
Remember her? Because I find that these people were extraordinary. They were not at all the stereotypical people that we think of as Texas Dust Bowl.
Yes, the thing I remember the most was she was always cooking, and she could, you know, with one potato and a tiny bit of mayonnaise in the fridge, she could whip up the biggest meal, and it was delicious.
Absolutely.
And it was anytime anybody came over, they had to eat, and it didn't matter if you had just eaten, you had to eat. And I remember that. But she did tell me stories about growing up in Texas with, like, I think she was one of 10 kids. And you know, they had an outhouse and they had the old pump outside for getting water. And it's just hard to believe, you know. It's you hear about that in history books, and it seems so far removed.
It is, because, you know, Dad, coming from those very humble circumstances, and told me that, you know, the main dinner on Sunday was ham and pink angel food cake. I mean, really. And in his 30s, he was invited to the Wine and Food Society of Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
Which never took anybody. Until they met Dad and realized his knowledge of wine and food was unparalleled, you know. So how he got from there to there, I can't figure out, except that he was brilliant, you know.
Yeah.
When UCLA first started the Arboretum, they went to Dad for advice on how to lay out and plant the Arboretum.
I mean, really?
Where did Dad get where? Maybe he just had an insatiable knowledge, a thirst for knowledge. But he knew everything about everything, and when he met Vincent Price, of course they got along absolutely beautifully. They were so like each other, you know. And Vincent said, "Okay, we're going to tour Europe, and I'm going to teach you about the great masters." Oh, and Vincent and Dad would tour Europe and collect art. And Vincent Price's art collection is second to none.
That's, you know,
it may be Vincent Price that taught Dad a lot of what he knew.
Wow. How amazing is that? To have Vincent Price showing you around Europe and teaching you about the masters.
Well, my Mai Tai is empty, and that means I've got to mix up another one, because we are continuing on to part two with Leslie Baxter. I don't know what I'm going to call this. Growing Up Leslie, or The Wonderful World of Les Baxter, something like that. I think there's an album by that title. Anyway, I hope you all enjoyed this as much as I did, and definitely come back for part two. We talk about a lot more stuff, and I hope you learned some stuff, as I did. Absolutely fascinating. So the track you're listening to right now is called Monica, and it is from the album Round the World with Les Baxter, another one of his great albums. So I'm going to leave you with this, and I will go mix up another Mai Tai, and I'll see you on the other side. Aloha.